Jennifer Byrne is an Associate Professor in Law at the University of Technology in Sydney and also the Director of Anti-Slavery Australia and joins us. Hello, Jennifer.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm well, Jennifer. When I first heard that speech given, which was a beautiful speech, I thought one of the best speeches at the Academy Awards because it wasn't so predictable. But when he said 21 million people who still suffer slavery today, I'm sure many people stopped and thought, geez, I didn't think there was slavery, and if there was, that there would be that many people.
I think that many people think that slavery is something that ceased, you know, hundreds of years ago. But what we know is that the International Labour Organization says that there are 21 million people in slavery around the world, and some of those people are in Australia. And, you know, at the international level, I think a really clear statement comes out of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which says that no one shall be held in slavery or servitude. Slavery and the slave trade shall be prohibited in all their forms. I think Steve McQueen was right. You know, people who are enslaved are controlled. They have no autonomy around their life's decisions. Everybody should be given the right to live their life.
Do we need to then define what slavery is, and is it different to perhaps what it was 50, 100 years ago?
Yeah, I think that's right. Slavery is defined in a convention which says that slavery is the condition of a person over whom any or all of the powers attaching to the right of ownership are exercised. And what that means in a nutshell is that a person is controlled, that they don't have the freedom to make decisions about the kind of work they do or how they do it. They're often subject to limitations on their freedom of movement. They might be threatened through psychological control or physical violence, subject to terrible treatment and forced labour. And people will stay in slavery, you know, because they're coerced. You know, they're forced, they suffer duress. Sometimes they're physically imprisoned. You know, they've been abused. And around the world, there are 21 million, even though, you know, it is very difficult to try and work out what the numbers are. But the International Labour Organization is a respected organization, and they've calculated that there are 21 million people in forced labour around the world, and they say that the majority of those people are in the Asia-Pacific region.
Now, does that mean that what can happen is that it's not a matter of ownership and people owned by somebody else? However, you may work in a situation by which you have to pay for your rent, you have to pay for a whole lot of things, and you can never pay that back, so you're always going to be in debt to somebody.
Look, that's spot on, and you're right. It's not legal ownership. Slavery has been abolished. It's not, you can't legally own a slave, but that's why the definition speaks of the condition of a person who is so coerced, so controlled, that they are not free to stop doing what they're doing. And not free to leave.
Tell us, because Andrew Forrest, a mining magnate, I mean, whether or not you agree with what mining companies do and all of that, which is a separate issue, but what he was saying, that what he felt that he could free 2.5 million people from slavery in Pakistan. I don't know if he can do that, but how is it there are 2.5 million people enslaved in Pakistan, and how?
Well, you know, people are enslaved in all countries around the world, and there is some, you know, legal blurring around definitions here, where, you know, there might be technical differences between slavery and forced labour, but, you know, it all boils down to the same thing, that people have no freedom to choose what they're doing and can't leave, and there's a whole bundle of, you know, vulnerabilities that make people susceptible to being exploited in this way, and some of those, you know, would include, you know, grave poverty, you know, lack of legal status, for instance, social isolation, so that there is no choice.
Because I mentioned there the rent aspect or something. Can you just, so that people understand, what are some of the ways that people can be controlled so that they don't have those freedoms?
Well, they can be controlled through threat. You know, unless you do this, I will harm you or your family. They can believe that they have a debt that they have to pay off, and if they don't pay that debt, they will never be free. They might be threatened, they might be beaten. They just have no choice. This is not a situation where a person can just decide that they don't really like the job that they're doing and go and find another job, or that they're finding, you know, a bit of mortgage stress and have to keep working. This is where there is something in addition to that, where there is real force and coercion that's stopping a person from leaving. So, you know, forced labour is something that that is prevalent around the world. You know, ILO says it's 21 million people, and you know, people are coerced either, you know, overtly through threat or through more subtle forms of coercion, and some of those could include the factors that you've mentioned.
Jennifer, a while ago there's that terrible story of the people working in the sweatshops in Bangladesh.
Yes.
And women who felt that they didn't have a choice because they had to pay for the rent to live where they were, and they got paid incredibly small amounts and were locked in. Is this an example of what would be considered slavery?
That might be an example of forced labour. If they're physically restrained, if they have no choice around what they're doing, if there's some element of coercion or duress. I think the Rana Plaza case, was... a case that really shook the world, and forced us all to think carefully about issues of supply chain and ethical procurement. It's clear that those women working in Rana Plaza were exploited. I don't know whether it was forced labour or slavery.
Which is where it's difficult to draw the lines between what is slavery and what is forced labour. There's trafficking as well involved in that as well.
Well, there could be there as well. And of course, when you think about the complexities in the trafficking definition, there's domestic trafficking for people moved from one place to another place within the same country. Now, and sometimes, of course, a form of exploitation might be slavery, forced labour and trafficking all at once. But in every single case, the common element is that there is control over a person's life.
Tell us, Susan.
Okay.
It's a really serious and awful subject. I worked in the sex industry for several years in Sydney, and it was commonplace in a lot of brothels to have especially Thai girls who spoke no English, kept there 7 nights a week. They might get a night off if it's someone's birthday and the boss is nice. They kept there until they have this supposed debt of the airfare. And, they cry a lot and there's nothing can be done.
Susan, and you're saying that it was relatively prolific.
Yes, yeah, it was. Sometimes the girls would run away and work in other brothels to try and earn their own money to get back home.
How did people get away with it, Susan?
I don't know who runs it. I know one place I worked a couple of years later, it was raided. Yet the boss I was working for told me there were places that were run a lot worse than what he was doing. They were not allowed to use any form of protection.
Jeez. You see, Susan, this is what you expect to hear in other countries but not in Australia.
Mm.
Jennifer, could you just want to comment?
Yeah. Susan, when were you working in Sydney? What time are you speaking about here?
I'm speaking about, it's going on 15 years ago.
Yeah.
And it was already in full swing, and I think it's gotten a lot worse.
Yeah. Are you still working in the industry?
No.
Okay. Look, the majority of cases that we know about in Australia have involved trafficking or exploitation of women in the sex industry. There's been a number of convictions in Australia, 18 so far, and the majority have been for people charged with slavery or servitude offences relating to exploitation of women in the sex industry. There's a lot of work that's been done by sex work advocates to boost protections for women in working in the sex industry in Australia. And I know that Scholars Alliance, for instance, has got a particular focus there. But you know, what we know is that this can happen in any industry, and it's very concerning to hear about this level of exploitation. We're aware of, I guess we have more awareness now about exploitation in other industries, such as domestic servitude now. But you know, what you've spoken about, you know, it's a terrible thing, and to think that that was happening in Sydney and may still happen.
Jennifer, if that's what's happening in Australia, then goodness knows what it would be like in Thailand, in Vietnam, in Indonesia, in so many other countries that this sort of practice would be commonplace.
I mean, it'd be good to talk with you, Susan, at some point, more about your experiences, and you can contact us through the web. But I think that's right. There are people exploited all over the world in terrible forms of slavery.
Josephine, good morning.
Good morning, Trevor. Thanks. This is really a very important issue to me as a mother and as a teacher. Children are being exploited all over the world. They are. It's a fact. Jennifer sort of stated almost as much. But I wanted to ask Jennifer a question. Is a drug traffickers who, you know, pimps and that, and who control drug addicts, are they classified as slave drivers?
Well, not so far. They'd be certainly classified as, you know, as potential criminals, but they're not usually thought of as slave owners. But I think when we actually think about the elements of slavery, it's important. So, you know, thinking about the condition of ownership, you know, if there is a person who controls another, you know, maybe through drug dependency, and there's some force there that requires that person to do something adverse, that could be slavery.
Josephine,
usually seen like that.
Yeah, Josephine, you also wanted to talk about child labour.
Yes, child labour in Southeast Asia. I mean, you know, families quite often, because they're so poor, are forced into the situation where they sell their children to big companies, and they work for nothing virtually, and they have them there, and they make cheap shoes and for the big companies all around the world. And that's a big concern to me. I support the Save the Children Fund.
Yeah. Jennifer, the child slavery is one that people bring up a lot. And a lot of what happens as far as slavery is concerned is through poverty, and especially when people have no other choices but to put their children into slave labour, which also can include the sex industry as well.
Well, the ILO says that of those 22 million people, 26% are under the age of 18. And we've seen a number of stories in Australia over the last year or so. Josephine, you would have seen these too, you know, where there are particular products in Australia that are compromised. So I'm thinking particularly of some sporting equipment. And World Vision had a particular focus there. But looking at the supply chain, I think is an important thing for all of us to do, you know, thinking about what it is that we're buying. And you know, if you think about a product like a football, for instance, you know, before our children play with that football, it's been passed through many hands, you know, including the producers of raw materials, people who sell the goods, who make it, and buy it in Australia. Each element of the supply chain can have a level of exploitation in it. And internationally, we know that there have been forced labour practices in industry such as the cotton industry or coffee and garments. And we've already spoken about Rana Plaza, for instance. but any industry can be compromised. And there is a growing movement in Australia and around the world to start thinking about ethical consumerism and to try and do what we can to make sure that we don't participate in exploitation of other people.
You're listening to Overnights with Trevor Chappell. My guest this morning is Jennifer Byrne, Associate Professor in Law at the University of Technology in Sydney and also the Director of Anti-Slavery Australia. And that's what we're looking at this morning. We heard on that speech on the Academy Awards the other day that 21 million people still live in slavery. How can that happen? What needs to be done about it? Jennifer, as we take a look at that slavery around the world, in which industries do we see it most? Is it also very active in the mining industry?
Look, there's been reports of exploitation in the mining industry, particularly in countries in Africa. We see it in any industry, anywhere where there's primary production or secondary production. So, you know, it could be in the mining industry, reports of people in forced labour in gold mining, for instance, in the production of jewellery, you know, in diamonds. We know about the concept of blood diamonds, for instance. But any kind of product can be susceptible to exploitation of people in the acquisition of that product.
Craig, good morning.
I just really take a little bit of offence to that comment about the consumer, the onus being on the consumer, because I think how does it get into the shops in the first place? It should never be there.
I guess we're one person in the chain, Craig.
Yes, but it doesn't come with a label. This was made by a child under slave labour, does it?
Yeah, and Jennifer...
You're supposed to pick up a product and go onto the internet and do hours of research to see where this product comes from. No, it should not get in... that research should be done by authorities before it even gets into the shops.
Which is a point that I was just going to talk to you about in a different way, probably, Craig. But who is it there then that is checking with the people that are the manufacturers, that are the miners? Who are the people that are supposedly making sure that this slavery doesn't exist?
Yeah, well, I think Craig's right too, that it's not just the consumer who's got a responsibility, and how can we check? I mean, what you'd know, Craig, is if you go into the supermarket, there are some products that are already labelled as being fair trade or ethically produced, but the majority are not. But I think that, you know, as consumers, we are part of the building of a global awareness, and we do have the power to ask companies to think about these issues. We ask governments as well, and there are, you know, structures at the United Nations level that are looking at this, looking at engaging business. There's a number of voluntary guidelines that countries are encouraged to abide by, but getting business interested is something that I think belongs to all of us. And if we as consumers start to say that we want to make sure that the products that we're buying are ethically produced, then, you know, that would have an impact. But this is part of an ongoing process, and we all have a responsibility.
Fair trade chocolate is a good example of that.
Yeah.
But it's a matter of, number one, knowing what it is, and number two, being able to find it. And within that, knowing what the story is behind it. There's an awful lot to find out as a consumer.
There is, and it's tough. It's not clear. It's confusing, and there are different kinds of certification systems. But I think that, you know, there is this awareness, and we can start to look at these issues and tell companies that's what we're interested in. So, this, for instance, there's been a lot of advocacy with some chocolate manufacturers, most recently in Cadbury, for instance, in Australia, where particular lines now are all made, are all certified as being fair trade. Coming up to Easter, you'll see that there are many, many forms of chocolates that are ethically produced. So it's part of a global movement and a global interest. But really, the responsibility is a joint responsibility between government, business and consumers.
It's interesting, because, and I'm not sure where this fits in, but it's an interesting point that Tony makes about the overseas bride industry. This is not only in Australia, but all around the world, of whether or not it's taking advantage of people's vulnerability, especially women overseas. And there are some pretty dodgy, I'm not saying they all are, but there are some pretty dodgy businesses overseas as far as overseas brides are concerned.
No, well, if we're thinking about Australia, I think the majority of women sponsored into Australia is partners of Australians would be in a genuine relationship with the Australians. There's been some concern at Parliament and in community organisations about the use of the partner visas as a vehicle for trafficking. And this really highlights the point that we were discussing earlier, that trafficking and exploitation can happen in any area. And this is an area of particular concern because it is really invisible. Most of us wouldn't think about trafficking within the marriage visa system, for instance, and yet there are cases. Sometimes these cases come to the attention of community organisations or government because of some other kind of harm, for example, family violence. And with some investigation, it becomes clear that there is, in fact, there has been trafficking, or even in some rarer cases, forced marriage and then further exploitation. But this is something that is important to think about. It is something that happens in Australia.
Jennifer, is there a need to look at the differences there are in countries and, how can you put this, cultural differences? In India and in Pakistan, there are very strong caste systems by which there are some people that are going to be in poverty because that's the way their lives have always been.
Mm-hmm.
Are there difficulties in getting rid of some forms of slavery because there is part of it that is cultural?
I think cultural and also structural. So, you know, looking at the vulnerabilities that keep people in slavery could include some of those factors that you've indicated. And this really highlights the importance of looking carefully at whatever those vulnerabilities are in each country, in each community, and they will be different, and then addressing that on those issues on a systemic issue. But, you know, often in the Australian context, you know, we focus on education, the importance of education in changing thinking about practices, and that's something where there should be a focus around the world.
Peter joins us. Good morning, Peter.
I know that Craig a few minutes ago was upset that consumers had the responsibility, or, you know, that somebody said that Genevieve mentioned about consumers having responsibility, but ultimately it's always up to the consumer. You know, we live in a society with very, very long supply chains that go further and further away, and one of the examples I'd like to give is you know, cheap tins of tomatoes at the supermarket.
Uh-huh.
You know, we're not prepared to spend money for the, you know, for the employment to stay in Australia, and we can produce these very easily and very, in inverted commas, cheaply, you know, but that's because we're paying workers to have decent lives here in Australia. And, you know, if we're demanding 99-cent tins of tomatoes, or even cheaper, 79-cent tins of tomatoes, then somebody's got to be exploited along the way.
This is where the line between exploitation and slavery can get a little bit difficult, Jennifer, because people may be getting paid, but it may not be paid as far as other people would consider to be a reasonable level of payment.
I think Peter's point is important, and we can have all the structures in the world, at government level, international law, and think about the issues on the ground, but when it comes to the checkout, we don't know whether, you know, people will think about paying more for the can of tomatoes. You know, we're all interested in saving money where we can, but, you know, thinking about exploitation of people, I think, is something that's really critical. And the earlier point that Craig made is right. We just don't know what the situation is for the many kinds of products that we can buy. But you know, the cheap tomatoes really is an indicator that there could be some level of exploitation involved.
There have to be,
or cheap tomatoes, or cheap anything.
There's a need to be very careful as well, Jennifer. If we're going to go in and say, okay, you're not getting paid enough money. And there is a form of forced labour happening here. So we're going to do something about it, and we're going to cut that off and make that not exist anymore. Then those people who were working then all of a sudden have nothing.
Yes,
so if we don't put into place the right practices, we're actually going to make life worse for these people.
Yeah. So the principle of, you know, remediation is really important. So to put practices in place that ensure that there isn't exploitation, that people can keep their jobs, it's really important. So, you know, there's sometimes the thought that we should ban purchasing of a product that might be compromised, and that would have the effects that you've just indicated. And all that would mean is that, you know, the next town, the next city starts producing those products. So, you know, working with specific people, making goods as part of a supply chain is critical.
Neville, hello.
No, I'm not really complaining about spoiled labour, but I worked in a disabled field. I actually had a full-time job. Then I got sick, then I had to take a disability pension, and I was put in a sheltered workshop. Then I was one stage on up to $16 an hour.
Mm-hmm.
Then they come along with a wage assessor, and they drop my wage from a ridiculous wage down to nearly $6 an hour.
Neville, I'm really glad you made that point, because there's an issue of exploitation in comparison to what's considered to be slavery or forced labour, and that's been well documented. And the changes that are supposedly going to happen by the federal government in this regard at the moment, Jennifer.
Yeah, well, we do have new laws in Australia that, in fact, came into effect about a year ago to protect people against forced labour in Australia. It was part of a package of new legislation that also included an offence of forced marriage. I don't know about the details in that particular sector, Neville, but it would be worth contacting the Fair Work Ombudsman perhaps to discuss those issues. And $6 an hour seems low. It would be below the national employment standard. So following up with the Fair Work Ombudsman would be a good first step, I would have thought.
There is a push at the moment for wages to be looked at and to take a look at how much people are worked and whether or not they get overpaid in industry and that sort of thing. And when you take a look at what's happening overseas, we do pretty well in Australia. However, who are the people that are the arbiters? Who are the people that go into the industries overseas and say this practice isn't good enough and you need to be lifting your standard?
Yeah, well, there's a whole practice of supply chain auditing, and companies are required to report against certain standards. But this highlights the difficulties in the supply chain. And this was raised earlier by Peter when he was talking about products at the supermarket, that there are many different stages in the production of goods, and there could be exploitation in each one of those stages. And, you know, if you think about it, you know, it's the people who produce, you know, the basic products, the raw materials, people who are involved in assembling that, you know, for sale. And then in international supply chains, there are brokers, distributors, wholesalers and retailers, and companies and people that they employ together are all part of that very, very long supply chain.
Are we starting to see unions forming and people to represent workers within those industries, within those countries?
Well, we have unions in Australia, and there are unions in some of the overseas countries that might be involved, but this goes to the broader issue of protection for workers. Clearly, unions are a part of that, and there are international unions as well as specific unions in each country. But as well as that kind of agitation and that kind of direct focus on the well-being of an individual person, we also need at the law level, good, strong labour laws and protections and enforcements of those laws. Many countries would have laws on their books against slavery, but how well are those laws implemented? So a law itself is insufficient. There also needs to be really good implementation as well. And sometimes in vulnerable communities, that will involve some level of cultural change or structural reform as well.
And within that, the responsibility of overseas companies going into where countries where the workforce isn't paid as well or where the workforce are being exploited, saying, well, okay, we're going to be a company that is above that and we're going to try and lift the standards of workers within here instead of taking advantage of it.
Yeah, and that's where we as consumers have a responsibility to tell companies that that's what we want, that we don't want to be buying goods that are compromised through the exploitation of people.
And that did work with a certain manufacturer of sporting goods where it was highlighted how much money they were making out of a pair of shoes, and there was a backlash by the community, which worked.
Yeah, that's right. And we've seen the same, thing in football, for instance. Like, the consumer does have an enormous power here to push the company, and that can work. It's an important thing, but it's that initial investigation can be very difficult to find out exactly what's happening on the ground.
Is it also an issue of women's rights as well, in that there is far greater exploitation of women than men?
You're right there, and that's another thing that the ILO says, that the majority of people in forced labour around the world are women working in a whole variety of industries. So it could be an issue of gender equity, access to education, poverty, a whole bundle of factors that can keep women in forced labour.
Isn't it incredible how we live in a society now where we believe in equality, we believe in the rights of the child? There are so many different things that are signed off by government taking a look at these things. But when push comes to shove, these things still exist, and especially the most vulnerable.
And that's where, thinking about coming into International Women's Day is really important. I mean, this is something that Australia is celebrating in the next few days, International Women's Day. It's been an important part of our national calendar where we think about issues of gender equity and think about the improvements that can be made so that all people in Australia, for instance, do have equal access to employment, to education, to life.
We sign off on so many conventions, the rights of the child and all of these things. Are they really worth the paper that they're written on, that we may say that, yes, we're a great believer in this and we've signed off on this convention and we believe all of these, but do governments necessarily act on the conventions they sign off on?
Well, there'd be huge differences around the world, but thinking about Australia, for instance, we have signed off on conventions such as the one you mentioned, the rights of the child, and the Slavery Convention, Forced Labour Conventions, the Trafficking Convention, and with those signatures comes responsibilities. And, in those areas, there are often also reporting mechanisms at the international level where Australia will go to the United Nations or whichever organisation is supervising those conventions and speak about what we are doing as a nation to fulfil our obligations at international law. But there are differences around the world, and in the same way that having a national law itself will not cure ills, signing an international convention won't automatically cure ills either. There has to be a real commitment at government level and implementation of the spirit of the convention, and then sometimes changes within the way things are organised to ensure that the principles of international law, human rights, are upheld.
Jennifer, do you think I've got a text here that say, what about the role of governments? And I guess that's what we're leading into now.
Mm-hmm.
Are governments, do they put this on the back burner? Because if you want to compare it with trade or you want to compare it with other issues, this one's always in the sticky pile that's a little bit too hard to bring up.
Yeah, well, I'll speak first of all about Australia and then to make some general comments about other governments. That in Australia there's been a government push that's been bipartisan since 2003 to look at human trafficking, slavery, forced labour and forced marriage. And as a result of a lot of consultation and thinking, Australia did get new laws last year that came into effect on International Women's Day. Australia has had a financial commitment through the Australian government to raise awareness about these issues, to investigate and to prosecute people involved in these crimes. And this is something that, that is continuing with the new focus now on, at government level on forced marriage, but also on supply chains. So, you know, the Australian government has recently issued a statement relating to supply chains and asks that people who are involved in providing goods and services to the Australian government think about these issues of forced labour in a supply chain. But internationally, governments have responsibilities too. Many governments have signed the international treaties that we were talking about, but in some countries around the world, there is still a lot more to do. The international mechanisms are important because they can highlight what's happening in particular countries. The media also does that. There is a range of non-government organisations involved, and we saw in this film that's just done so well at the Oscars, 12 Years a Slave, that there are many ways that we can raise awareness about these issues. And while that film showed slavery during the Civil War, we know that the elements of slavery now are exactly the same as they were shown in that film. So there's many levels of responsibility around the world.
And those of us who are everyday punters, the first thing that we can do is take a look at the things that we buy and maybe do a little bit of our own research.
Yeah, and to think about exploitation. If we think that a person might be living in exploitative conditions, think about what we can do. Even talking to that person, may be a critical step. We've seen cases in Australian law where people have been enslaved in broad daylight. So, for instance, a woman who was working in a takeaway food shop, on the main street in northern Queensland,
Jennifer,
was enslaved.
We all have to be aware, and thank you very much for joining us on the program.
Oh, you're welcome, Trevor. Thank you.